Hello, and welcome to AI Curious. My name is Jeff Wilser. I'm a journalist, I'm a human, and I'm curious about AI. And in my mind, one of the most legit, substantive, and truly exciting use cases for AI is in the world of healthcare, health tech, and medical advances. And that gets us to today's guest, who is at the tip of the spear of this, Dr. Brian DeCaro, president and CEO of Sherlock Biosciences. Sherlock is a biotech company that is developing diagnostics tests, in part using AI, that are much faster, much cheaper, and much easier to implement than traditional tests. Why does this matter? This could be anything from STDs to infectious diseases that cause pandemics. Anyone who has any thoughts or memories about COVID will find this interesting. Brian walks through the current state of play of diagnostic testing, how they usually work. And I asked, frankly, some very basic, super naive questions at the start, just to kind of make sure we have our definitions straight and to bring this, what can be a very abstract concept, more concrete. So at the beginning, you might be like, well, of course I know what diagnostic means, like duh. But I thought it was important to first establish a firm baseline. And from there, we walk through how this could all change and be dramatically improved. And eventually, I think Brian and I get to a pretty interesting place looking at some possible new exciting scenarios, such as the ability for all of us at home at a low cost to be able to swab and easily screen for cancer kind of on our own and have those tests be as accurate as the current model when you go to a doctor's office and it takes days or weeks to figure this stuff out. If that all happens, and there are many hurdles to get through to make it happen, but if it does, it's not a stretch to say things like this can literally save millions of lives. Again, there is a ton of kind of wacky and silly stuff about AI out there. This is not that. This is, in my mind, again, as substantive and exciting as it gets as far as how AI can help healthcare become far more inclusive. It could reach millions, if not billions, of more people. Again, this is not an overnight process. There's obviously a ton of issues to work through, and Brian and I discuss all that stuff. But I, for one, find it pretty tantalizing of a possibility. So with that, please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Brian DeCaro, president and CEO of Sherlock Biosciences. Dr. DeCaro, welcome to the pod.
Thank you for the invite. Appreciate it.
So let's start with the lay of the land. Before Sherlock, before AI, what are the problems with today's diagnostics? What's the baseline status quo?
Yeah, there are several problems with diagnostics today. I think the number one problem is accessibility. Today, you know, around the world, when you need a diagnostic, you need to find a healthcare provider, get into the healthcare system, and wherever you are in the world, and then get access to a test. And so that's one of the biggest issues that the world faces is how do we actually bring tests to where the people are, where they want to access it, and make it also affordable for them to access diagnostics, right? And so accessibility, affordability are key. I think one of the other aspects is just the cost of developing diagnostic. It can take years to develop a diagnostic, get it approved by regulatory agencies. And so speed of development is another issue. So with that kind of costs associated with it, you have to pick which ones you can go after. And so there's a lot of orphaned conditions, a lot of less frequent testing needs that are out there, which makes those harder to develop diagnostics for because it's just you have to have enough people to have a diagnostic to spend years developing a diagnostic. And I think the most important piece is accuracy. You know, we really want our diagnosis to be accurate. If it's not, then, you know, why are you getting, you know, then you're going to get a wrong diagnosis or a false positive or false negative. And so you really want accuracy, especially if typically diagnostics lead to treatment and you don't want to have the wrong treatment by having the wrong diagnosis. So it's really important.
What are the most important and most common types of diagnostics we're talking about here? What's the cluster of the big ones that your team is focused on and that in general matter to the world right now?
If you look at the whole globe, the most important diagnostics are for infectious diseases, you know, whether it's the next outbreak, pandemic. Infectious diseases are the most common causes of morbidity and mortality around the globe, from both viruses, bacterial, fungal infections, and other aspects. I think if you also then look in a lot of high-income countries, and also even in low- and middle-income countries, you know, prenatal diagnostics or perinatal diagnostics around birth and children, as well as cancer diagnostics, are some of the more advanced diagnostics that are coming out today to help treatment selection or to even find out that you may have early detection of cancer. And so these are some of the big areas of focus for diagnostic development around the world.
Is there any one particular type of diagnostic that looks most promising, most ripe for improvement with AI? And of course, we'll get into AI momentarily, but what are the one or two or three? They're like, okay, if we get this right, here's a real opportunity to improve accuracy and to lower costs and dramatically increase accessibility.
So Sherlock, I kind of look at it a little bit different, which is that, you know, over the past 30 years, when we've developed genetic technologies to amplify DNA, we moved a lot of diagnostics from low accuracy, you know, protein antibody type of tests to very high accuracy molecular tests. And if you remember during the pandemic, people were saying you need to have a PCR test for COVID, not a rapid test that you're getting from your doctors in order to, you know, travel and things like that, because they were high accuracy tests, right? But the issue with high accuracy tests is they're not able to be decentralized. You have to go to really high complexity labs to get them out. And at Sherlock, we've developed a lot of novel chemistries in synthetic biology, CRISPR, and other ways to amplify up DNA, RNA, these molecular tests, and bring them at lower costs and more simple devices in a decentralized fashion around the world that people can afford. But the issue with novel chemistries is no one's used them before. And this is where I feel like AI has the ability to really be a game changer in diagnostics, because, you know, for 30 years, people have been using PCR to amplify up DNA, RNA. They've had 30 years to advance the tools on how to make assays. Every huge diagnostic company, Thermo Fisher, Danaher, Roche, have all been using PCR for years. They know how to design. You know, when we start moving to CRISPR synthetic biology approaches to diagnostics, we're at Sherlock the only people who have experience with them. And so we have to use AI in order to understand what's working, what's not, and quickly harness all the data that we're generating to better design assays. And eventually what's important is we need to turn those AI algorithms outward so that the world can use the algorithms to design assays instead of having to be experts in these novel chemistries. And so the nice thing about AI is it's making it easy for lay users to become scientific experts by not having to be experts, but by having the algorithms design assays for them.
That's so interesting. Before we get deeper into the AI-ness of it all, I want to make sure I have a clear understanding of the diagnostic problem. I get at a high level, we want to improve accuracy. I get we want to make it easier, cheaper, faster, all that stuff. I just want to be extra concrete on what these diagnostic tools look like today. So maybe if you can sketch out, not to be really silly and reductive here, but maybe in two different scenarios, in both like a relatively high income country like the US, when someone like, I'm guessing your average podcast listener of this podcast, goes to a doctor, what are we talking about as far as a diagnostic tool? And then let's look at a developing country where we want to help stop infectious diseases. Like what's the actual, are we talking about swabs in mouths that then gets fed to a lab? Just kind of help walk me through what the kind of current mechanics are. And then I think we'll give us a better understanding of where in that process AI is injected to speed things along or improve accuracy.
Yeah, definitely. So let's just start with the process today. So today, for most diagnostics are centralized. What I mean is advanced laboratories have to run them, okay? And so what happens is a patient or somebody who needs a diagnosis is going to go into some form of a health system, whether that is, you know, a hospital, a doctor's office, or, you know, a tent that's been set up to help some new community deal with some acute diagnostic issue.
Can you give an example? One concrete example of what the issue could be, an infectious disease or
something? Yeah, absolutely. So infectious disease is a perfect example. So, you know, you have COVID as an outbreak, or you have an Ebola outbreak, or, you know, you have sexually transmitted disease like chlamydia or gonorrhea. You just have symptoms. You're going to the doctor. Like every time you go to the doctor today with symptoms, are typically going to say, hey, you may have A, B, C, or D diagnosis. I don't know. Why don't we get you a blood sample or a urine sample or a saliva sample? I'm going to send it to a lab, order a bunch of tests, and I'm going to use those diagnostic results to figure out what's going on. And so it's typically symptom-based. And then what are the most common causes of those symptoms? And most of the time, it's some form of infection, whether it's a bacterial or viral infection. And once you get that sample is then sent somewhere else, like transported to a lab where there's very expensive equipment that are processed, and then they're ran through this equipment, and then the results are transmitted back to the doctor a few days later and says, here's what the results of all that testing was, and then the doctor can understand what's happening for that patient. So it's not fast. It takes days, and
it's not cheap. I guess it sounds like there's transport costs, and it also, I'm guessing it's not a great carbon footprint given all of the transportation, storage machinations involved. This is a fairly energy intensive process that you're describing.
And that's the process on the lab side. But imagine the process on the people side. Like you have to take time off work, figure out who's going to take care of your children or take your kids with you, make an appointment, get to that place, transport yourself to that place, get that sample collected. Then you're still worried and you're concerned. And maybe there's a speed, like you're going downhill fast and you really want a quick answer, but now you're waiting 2 or 3 days for the result. You're going back home, you're worrying. Then you may find out what you have and now you need to go to the pharmacy, get a medication, pick it up, start it. Like there's a lot of time that you're moving around that you're trying to figure out, how am I covering that? And you have a lot of social economic loss because you're not working or taking time off. It's complicated.
Thank you for that very crystal clear kind of lay of the land. I appreciate you indulging my very basic question. So now with that context, talk about how AI could accelerate and simplify this process. And then I'd love to hear about what your team has been doing to incorporate those kind of AI solutions.
Yeah, and I'll kind of try to hit them both at the same time, if that's okay, because, you know, I mentioned this inability to access diagnostics, right? This taking time off work or going places. The reason is because you have to go to the doctor, you have to get that sample, you have to send it to a high complexity lab, and you have to wait for a result. And so with novel chemistries that have just come out in the past decade or so, like CRISPR and synthetic biology approaches, these chemistries uniquely allow diagnostics to have that same accuracy, but to be in very simple to use, low cost devices that anyone in the world can use wherever they're at. So not at a doctor's office, but right at home in a tent while they're traveling. But these are new chemistries, right? And so with new chemistries, no one knows how to use new chemistries. So that's a big place that AI can help. How to use these new chemistries that no one knows how to use. And I can go a lot deeper on that in a second.
Do you mean helping doctors understand how to use it?
Scientists.
Or actual end users and patients? Right. Scientists. Okay.
So there's hundreds of diagnostics out there today, but they're not using these new chemistries. And so what you need to do is say, okay, if I'm going to use this new chemistry like CRISPR, and I want to design a chlamydia or gonorrhea, let's just use as an example, a chlamydia or gonorrhea test, I need to now design the chemical components with this new chemistry that is going to be able to detect the DNA from a chlamydia or gonorrhea bacteria and see whether you accurately and then see whether you're positive or not. So you have to design your lab assay to detect that, right?
Can we define a little more in this context, new chemistry, and then even CRISPR? Obviously, I think a lot of listeners will have heard of CRISPR, have a vague idea of what it is, but if you can connect the dots on what new chemistry is, how it fits into this, and then how CRISPR is deployed in this kind of solution.
Let me just use chlamydia as an example. So let's stay on this chlamydia example, right? So when you have chlamydia, you know, you may or may not have symptoms, but you can typically collect, a penile meatal swab or a vaginal swabbing, within your vagina or like a urine sample. And inside that urine sample is going to be a whole bunch of things, right? Let's just like, or in that vaginal swab sample, you're going to have human matrix that's inhibitory because we don't want things to penetrate into our body, right? Now, number two, you're going to have human DNA. You're also going to have a whole bunch of bacteria, not just potentially chlamydia bacteria, gram-negative bacteria, but you're going to have a whole host of other bacterial, maybe some viruses, other things that are there. And so you're just going to have this big soup that's on the tip of this swab, and you're going to put it into this buffer, and you're going to try to break open that chlamydia bacteria. But you're going to also break open all the human's DNA, all these other, like you're just going to create this big soup of DNA, right? And proteins and things in there, right? So now your diagnostic test has to be able to go into that liquid, find the piece of DNA that it's looking for, in this case, chlamydia DNA, locate it, amplify it so that you can actually, amplify it means just so that you can increase the signal from very, very little amounts to a ton of that one amount. And then you have to come in there and detect it. And so what we do at Sherlock is we have new ways to amplify just that specific chlamydia target. And then the CRISPR, which is another protein, will actually come in and only detect the presence of that target if it is there. And so if you're positive for chlamydia, it will say yes. It will detect it and it will say, yes, I'm positive. And if it's not there, it will say, no, it's, you're not positive. And you know, CRISPR is very specific. You've heard about it for gene editing because it's very, very, very specific at detecting what it wants to detect. In this case, it's used to detect the presence of the target that you wanted to amplify. So that's how it kind of works. But there's a lot of complexity there too, which is what part of the chlamydia do you want? What are there any overlapping sequences like DNA that's in chlamydia that's also in other bacteria? Because you wouldn't want that because then you would be amplifying up not chlamydia, but some other bacteria that may be harmless and getting a false positive, right? You know, or you may be amplifying your own DNA and getting false positive results, right? And so you need to create a very, very sensitive and specific detection of just that chlamydia DNA target. And that's where AI becomes really important. So try a different analogy, which is...
Sorry, Ryan, real quick. That model, an example, super helpful. Just to connect the dots further, where does new science, is what you described all, quote, new science? Or new chemistry, pardon me.
The, 30 years ago when PCR was invented, we learned how to amplify up DNA. And so that was the first time that diagnostics became DNA-based versus like protein-based. So we had a big leap back in the 80s and early 90s to very high accuracy diagnostics because we moved to using DNA. But PCR, actually, I think most people in the world have heard of PCR. It's on CSI and everything for genetic testing. That takes very advanced machineries because to use that type of chemistry requires a lot of thermal manipulation, hot, cold cycles. It takes time. So it's very specialized, expensive equipment. We recently have developed synthetic biology approaches to amplify DNA that don't require PCR. So, for example, they work at room temperature. They don't need any heat at all. They don't need any thermal dynamics. It can just work whatever temperature your studio is right now, it can work to amplify up that target. So that's what I mean by new chemistry, is we have a new way to amplify up pieces.
Meaning synthetic, largely. Synthetic data and synthetic framework to help detect the DNA or pathogen.
That's right. We're taking the scaffold of the chlamydia bacteria or a human genome, but then we're synthetically copying it, and we're doing that in a way that we then create multiple copies of it so that pretty soon the only thing you're able to see in that liquid is just the thing that you wanted to amplify. And we're making a lot of synthetic copies of that DNA, and we're doing that in a way that requires no batteries, no heat, no specialized equipment. You can just sit there at room temperature and all of a sudden synthetically create all of this specific DNA that you want to see. In this case, chlamydia DNA.
Very helpful. And I think I see where this is going now. And can you kind of bring us home on the AI front of how AI is helping to facilitate, accelerate this synthetic
That's
process?
Right. So what we see today is when you have a novel chemistry, you have to figure out how am I going to amplify that specific target and not others. And so I'm going to change analogies here. Imagine you're saying you're trying to find life on another planet, right? So, I mean, I think the lay user can get this thinking, right?
Sure.
You're trying to find life on another planet. Now, what most people do is they just go, well, maybe Venus has life, or maybe Mars has life. Why don't we just go to our nearest neighbors and look right in our solar system, right? Or you might go, oh, I see that closest star near us, that might have a planet that bears life, and so I'm going to go out there. What we do with AI is we say, no, let's first just go to every possible universe out there. So let's not look nearest us or look under a lamppost. Let's go to all possible universes. And then let's look at all possible planets around all of those universes and distinguish what would be the most, you know, what is our definition of what could bear life? And now bring me back every possible planet that might meet that criteria. And now prioritize all of those planets to the one that's the highest likelihood to actually bear life. So you would all of a sudden find the highest likelihood planet out of all possible planets that would bear life. That's what we're doing with AI here at Sherlock is we say we're going to go detect chlamydia, right? We don't go and use the sequence that PCR has used for the past 30 years that everybody has used, the exact same target, exact same place. We go out and we pull every possible chlamydia sequence that's ever existed in any database, right? We pull them all in. We then say, we can design this in any part of that entire genome of all of those genomes. And then we say, for this particular chemistry, which is brand new and novel, what are the pieces of chlamydia that would lead to the highest accuracy test that we could possibly find? And then the AI algorithms churn through all that data, churns through millions and millions of sequences and say, this is the area of DNA in chlamydia that you should amplify. That will be perfect for your chemistry, will work high accuracy and really distinguish chlamydia over any other possible bacteria or human or any type of other sequence out there. It's highly specific and it's perfect for your chemistry. And it will work the first time. And it will give us the best assay right off the bat. And that's what we're doing with AI. And not only that, but these bacteria, like we saw with COVID, for example, with the viruses, it kept mutating. It kept changing. So we use AI to also future-proof. What we do is we say, now look at all those chlamydia sequences. Look how they're all different. They have spots where they're different. What's the rates of all of the differences? Because those are areas that are really hot spots for changes. Let's avoid those so that if this chlamydia starts to adapt and starts to change and evolve, our assay won't need to change or evolve to continue to be a good diagnostic. So we also use AI to future-proof the test. So not only make the best assay today that's possible with what we know, but also to guess what we don't know and make sure that we actually can detect things in the future that don't even exist today.
Brian, I think that was the first time in history anyone has ever mashed up a search for life in the universe and chlamydia analogy, but it works. You nailed it. That's great. That really did help me understand this. Thank you for your patience. With that in mind, give us a sense of the real world impact of this. If you guys get it right, what would it take in today's world? Like whether in the measure of 3 days going to the lab at a cost of X thousand dollars or whatever. And then in this new AI injected new chemistry worlds, it then takes Y hours or minutes or days, and what percent cost decline are we talking about? Give us a sense of how this theoretically could dramatically lower cost and speed things up.
Yeah. Typically diagnostics used to take something on the order of 2, 3, 4 years to develop. It's like one test, like that chlamydia test I gave you, one test could take you 3 to 4 years to go from, I want to detect chlamydia, to something that actually is working and ready to go into a clinical trial. That's a long time. When we had the COVID outbreak, everyone in the world, like all diagnostic scientists, came together and said, we're going to create a diagnostic so that we can detect this and start treating this in individuals around the world. The whole diagnostic community came together and said, let's try to do this together and do this very, very fast. So they were able to really go from, what was around that, if you remember back that February, March timeframe that we started getting locked down and started getting that first sequence of COVID, to getting tests on the market in what I would say is a matter of like 3 or 4 or 5 months. And so we had this big gap, and then all of a sudden we started getting a whole bunch of tests. Well, that shaved off 4 years down to like 3 or 4 months, right? During that same period of time at Sherlock, we were able to get the first ever CRISPR-based diagnostic for COVID. And it was the first authorized use of CRISPR ever, whether it was therapeutic or diagnostics, when Sherlock got a CRISPR-based diagnostic ready in about a 2 to 3 month period of time. And got it, authorized by FDA. That was very, very fast. We can now, because again, we're harnessing these AI algorithms, we're using them faster. We can now do this in the matter of weeks. Someday it will just be in the matter of days where you just put in your target, you run your in silico AI algorithm, it just programs it out to the facility, which makes the compounds. And within 2 or 3 days, you're already testing it in your decentralized devices and are ready to get it out to the rest of the world. And that's the speed that AI is bringing to development.
That's amazing. If I hear you right, there's definitely massive speed gains on the diagnostic development front. Is there also an impact on the deployment fronts on when it's out there in the field? Like you mentioned earlier, currently you need to go take childcare, go to doctor's office, and it just takes 3 to 4 days to get analyzed. Talk a little bit about how this new model speeds things up from the actual patient use front as well.
Yeah. It's not necessarily the AI that's speeding that up, but it is indirectly. So as I mentioned, we have at Sherlock a lot of novel chemistries that simplify testing. So it maintains that accuracy that I mentioned about making highly accurate assays. It maintains that what you get in a central lab, but these technologies that require no heat, no batteries, and can be used by the lay user, not trained laboratory technicians, can get very low cost testing out to the masses wherever they're at. And you can do it yourself. You could just do it right there at your house. And if you remember back to the COVID days, we took a lot of these rapid antigen tests. Mm-hmm. They were protein based. We all learned how to use them very well, but they weren't very accurate. They're not very accurate. Mm-hmm. So now we're talking about lab accuracy, but in that similar way. But what AI will do is because it allows us to analyze a whole bunch of diagnostics at the same time, design them all at the same time, and can reduce that time from idea to product to a very short period of time, is it will allow us to take a whole host of tests that are done by doctors today and rapidly move them into a decentralized world. And so that speed of development and that lower cost of development will enable us to put a whole bunch of different types of tests out to a decentralized access.
I'd love now to widen the lens a little bit and think more globally in the sense of what does this all mean and why does it matter? Can you share a bit about why this is important and exciting to you and how, if we really get this right, if we really crack this code, what could the impact be to the world as far as diseases, health benefits, any number of beneficial downstream impacts?
Yeah, there's numerous, and I'll just pick a few different examples that will, I think, resonate with different listeners of this podcast. So the first one I would talk about is we just went through this pandemic, but as we grew up, we all heard about Ebola outbreaks and other outbreaks around the globe. So imagine that you're, you know, at the forefront, let's say you're in the Congo or forefront of some type of potential hemorrhagic fever outbreak like Ebola or other aspect. If you could have tests that were easy to use that could measure the top 30 different things that are likely due to, you know, fevers or something that's causing a hemorrhage to occur, you could quickly just take that first patient out there in a jungle or in a tent, anywhere you are, grab that sample, put it across multiple different devices that were all for different potential causes. And within the matter of like 15, 20 minutes, you would know what was the cause, what was the outbreak, and you could stem that outbreak rapidly. And in fact, whenever you knew what the cause was, let's say you found out it was Ebola, you could then say, I need a lot of these Ebola tests to be shipped out here so that we can start testing everybody rapidly. And you could just port them all out there. So that's one example of a decentralized testing that would really help with the speed, you know, to squash the next type of outbreaks that would occur. But then you took something like I mentioned about chlamydia and gonorrhea, right? This is something, you know, sexual health is private, and people, you know, don't want to go to their physician. And typically, if you think of the segment that most needs testing, it's this like 14 to 30 year old population. They don't have a primary care physician, or in the U.S. they might still be on their parents' insurance. They don't want to go to the doctor. They are, you know, and if they had the opportunity to get a test privately at the pharmacy or shipped to them on Amazon or Uber Eats drop it off and get that test and get that result, there'd be a lot more screening, a lot more early detection, and then immediate, you know, treatment, where an antibiotic could just be shipped to your house, or you could pick it up at your pharmacy, and you could easily bend the curve on this growing prevalence of things like STDs in the U.S. and globally as well. And then if you think about more advanced places, you know, I have a lot of freckles. I know this is you may not have a video, but I have a lot of freckles, and you know, right now, maybe once a year, I need to go to the dermatologist and get a skin checkup to see if are any of these moles or freckles that are starting to bleed or whatever, are they melanoma? Am I going to have cancer? Well, imagine if I could just at any time just swab anything I'm worried about and just run it at home and find out whether it had cancer or not, right? I could just screen for cancer whenever I wanted to, whenever I was worried about something, no doctor's appointment, no concern, and it would really alleviate my anxiety. It would reduce my healthcare costs, and it would be something I could just do at my convenience when I need it. And we're really in a convenient world.
I am an extreme layperson here, but my limited understanding is that in the world of cancer prevention and detection, earlier is the name of the game. The earlier you catch things, that is the difference between life and death. So what you're suggesting is that there could be a at scale, massively cheap way for all of us to get to nip in the bud any cancer issues sooner. This is obviously something that in theory could save millions and millions of lives if we get this.
That's
right.
Correct. That's exactly what I'm saying.
That's incredible.
And right now there's a whole bunch of these advanced tests being made for the doctor's office. And it's our mixture of our novel chemistry at Sherlock with our AI platform that will enable the world to move all of their tests to a very decentralized fashion so that people can just do it at their own convenience wherever they're at.
You just outlined a truly astonishing, incredible, possible future. Let's now talk about the challenges that have to be overcome to make it happen, whether in dealer's choice on your end, whether these are technical challenges that your team is trying to conquer, Are there regulatory hurdles that are going to gum the works up for 5-10 years? Is it a cultural challenge, political? What are the main obstacles that have to be overcome to get to what you just sketched out?
So the first one is what I always call, you can't boil the ocean, right? Everybody says that, right? Meaning Sherlock cannot take the hundreds and hundreds of tests that exist today in the lab and move them by themselves, one by one, out of the doctor's office and into the home. No matter how fast that development time is, no matter how low a cost it is, it just takes a lot of effort to do that. And so what we wanted to do at Sherlock, and we planned it day one, is can we take our AI algorithms that allow people to move their diagnostics to our chemistry and to our platform and decentralize it? Can we turn those algorithms out so the world can use them for free? And they don't have to be an expert in our chemistries to just figure out, how do I turn my diagnostic into a decentralized diagnostic? And that's what we've been doing. And the biggest challenge is the user interface. It's not the AI algorithms. Like, you would think it's the AI algorithms, but with advances in machine learning and natural language processing, we've been able to really develop high accuracy AI algorithms to design assays. But now we need to turn it into a user interface so that the layperson can say, here's, I care about chlamydia, or I care about melanoma, like I just talked about, or I worry about Ebola, and I want to design something for Ebola with your chemistries. And they can just pull down their target, say, design it, and have it shipped to them for them to start working on in their labs. That is what we're trying to build. And it's having that right interface that people have that usability to access the algorithms without having to be a computational scientist, right? So that's what we're working on.
I'm guessing that one of the challenges also is the issue of trust and trust in AI. And that, of course, leads us to the question of risk. And I think a lot of folks, when they hear about AI, they think about all of the many ways AI has to make mistakes and goes sideways, right? People have seen the images of like six-fingered hands. We all know that AI, Gen AI, can, quote, hallucinate in ChatGPT, for instance, and just basically fancy way of saying make shit up. So obviously this is an issue that I'm sure you are keenly aware of, and your team is diligently every day working to minimize. Talk a bit about how you are addressing the risk of AI, what type of processes you put in place to like verify that, okay, cool, the synthetic new chemistry AI enabled model we have is as accurate, if not more accurate, than traditional techniques. How do you make sure there's no hallucinations? What are you doing to minimize risk, and how do you kind of convince others that, I know it might sound scary, but this is ultimately as sound and safe as traditional frameworks?
Yeah. You have to compare it to the gold standards today, which is what we do. And that's what takes extra time. And I think as you do enough comparisons to the gold standard, people will start believing it, because we don't want these hallucinations as well, where, you know, you're telling everybody that you have a high accurate test for chlamydia and it's picking up, you know, hundreds of different bacteria that are not chlamydia. Like, that would be right, a very inaccurate test. And so we have to compare it to the central lab gold standards and make sure that we're as accurate as what is out there today. But you also want these learning AI where you feed into it not just what you did right, but what you did wrong. And it's learning how to do more right than wrong, and it feeds that. And what we've learned here at Sherlock is, in order to harness your AI tool, you know, scientists always go with where they want to look. I want to look for chlamydia. And what we've learned is, when you look at all the possible universe space, I talk about this universe space, you know, there's probably a lot more, going back to this universe analogy, a lot more data in the black hole, because it's a very dense area that everything is collapsing, but you can't see it, right? And so our computational scientists are always giving our wet bench scientists black holes, meaning these unknown spaces that they've never tested before, so that we, if we feed back those information back to the AI algorithm, it will make it advance far faster than if we're just doing the things that we always are doing before. And so that's another really important piece. But it is this iteration of predict, test, learn, predict, test, learn, that gets you confident that you don't have these hallucinations, but at the same time, it increases the speed because of your confidence in just moving forward. But it will never take away this regulatory hurdle of always proving in patients that it actually works. Like, that's always critical in the world that I live in diagnostics, right?
As we wind down here, last few questions, do you have any sense of timeline of how many years until this kind of amazing future you outlined of being able to, at home, on my own, I can just swab and test for cancer, for example, or things? By timeline, I don't mean until when that's a beta testing or prototype, but when will that be a reality that the listeners of this podcast, it will be mainstream and normal to do things like use models like this to get fast, easy, cheap cancer screening or other types of diagnostics for different issues?
I think COVID was a very great enabler of this space because it showed that the lay user could test themselves, get the answer, and do the right thing. So that was step one. I think you'll see Sherlock launch its first, you know, over the counter to lay user, test for STDs with chlamydia, gonorrhea in 2025, and that will be test number one of new chemistries that enable high accuracy tests to get out there to the masses. And then I always use the analogy like the field of dreams, which is if you build it, they will come. Traditional diagnostic companies have made tests for these big central labs. And they slowly started making tests for like nurses or doctor's offices or pharmacists, right? It's like an incremental change towards a slightly less, you know, trained non-laboratory technician, but a doctor or a nurse or something. We're paradigm shifting that to anybody in the entire world who wants to test themselves, right? And so the big diagnostic industry doesn't believe that that can exist because they haven't seen it exist. And so as we bring our first two or three tests into the market and show that that market exists, just like, you know, Uber did or Netflix did or others who have really brought convenience to how we consume things, then that's when the world diagnostic groups are going to want to rapidly use this process and bring a bunch of their tests to the lay user. And so then you'll start seeing it like hit that tipping point and everything will take off from there.
Love that.
So I would say in the next decade, you'll see it, but the first one will be next year.
More generally, I know that Sherlock's purview is diagnostics, but you are immersed in this space. I'm guessing you have some thoughts on overall AI in the health tech and healthcare field. Any predictions on how else the world of medicine and healthcare can change the next 5-10 years thanks to AI advancements and adoption?
Yeah, I spent a lot of my career in what's called personalized medicine and also big data. I worked at insurance companies in the US that had access to patients' medical claims, patients' demographics. And that's a huge data set that we just still haven't harnessed enough where AI I've used it to do a lot and it can do a lot where you're looking at all the data that maybe you've generated in the healthcare system your entire life and maybe other data that's on your cell phone or other places. And you start to learn the individual and based upon changes in that individual's life, like other diagnoses that they have or changes in their mobility or changes to how often you go out with your friends, you know, these kind of changes, that would tell you that your health trajectory is changing in one way or the other. And algorithms can then tell you what you may be getting or what may be changing. And that will tell you what diagnostics you should have. And so I see a world where the data that we just generate throughout our life is telling us what's happening in our life and then tells us where the gaps are of information that I don't have, and then feed you the diagnostics that you need at the right time to fill those gaps so that you then know exactly what you need to do to move to a place where our healthcare system is a place of maintaining wellness instead of treating people who are sick. And that's where I see AI going in the healthcare system.
Amazing. Love that. And last question for you, a question I ask all of my guests. How are you personally using AI in your own life, whether for work or for funsies?
You know, I think probably other people may have said this before, but I laugh because I don't use AI much in my life. I use AI a lot in my work, and I've used it throughout probably the last decade or more of my career at work. And other than a little bit of help me write my resume or help me write a reference for somebody or so, have only used AI very little in my life. Now, I would tell you that with all of the books I read or apps I do on my phone, I'm sure AI is influencing my life
sure. All
over the place, but it's more passive than me actually out there utilizing AI approaches to improve my life. And I worry that all of a sudden I'm going to be blindsided by the AI revolution in my personal life because I've only harnessed the tools at work and not at home.
I think you're doing enough overall to help save millions of lives with AI that will give you a pass on this. So, Brian, thanks so much for joining. And thank you for walking us through many of my super basic questions. But I think it really did help give a kind of clear roadmap of what the value add here is and why it matters and how it impacts the world. So thank you for that. Thank you for all you're doing. Best of luck to InsureLab. Really appreciate it.
And thank you, Jeff. Really appreciate it too. I hope to see you soon and also to see other guests that you have because I always enjoy listening to you.
Thanks again, sir. Well, there you have it. Thanks again to Dr. Brian DeCaro, President and CEO of Sherlock Biosciences. Thank you for listening. I know that I took some time to kind of get to the good stuff as far as how AI can supercharge things, but I really found Brian's comments and analogies helpful to kind of get my arms around this fairly complicated subject and get a little more clarity to how it actually all works. I hope you enjoy. As always, please consider subscribing, rating 5 stars, sending to friend, all that good stuff. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.